Today is Monday, July 13, 2020, and this is Part 19, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Charles Butch Farabee, F-A-R-A-B-E-E. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Butch. How are you today?
Good, thanks, Tom.
Great. May we have your permission to record this oral history interview over the phone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. Last time we were talking about your varied projects that you were working on in Washington, D.C., and I wondered if there were a couple more things that you recall that you might want to talk about your time in D.C.
There's a couple, two at least, and I'm sure I'll think of more after we hang up.
Okay.
Well, the first one is, I think I mentioned a little bit about the hurricane coming up the coast. And I don't recall which hurricane, you know, after a while they blend in so much together. But the night before, Jack Moorhead had called us, a guy by the name of Jim Loach, another ranger that worked with me there. Jim Loach and I called him on the phone at home and said, you know, tomorrow morning you guys need to give a presentation, a briefing to the Secretary of the Interior on what at least the Park Service will be doing to respond to this hurricane, which is imminent, and will be going up the coast. And I think some of this I've already related to you, but it had to do with the bells and whistles. Well, the Secretary was either Don Hodel, H-O-D-E-L, or Manuel Manny Lujan, L-U-J-A-N, Jr., who was from New Mexico. I actually don't know Hodel's background. I can't remember it. And the directors at the time were either William Penn Mott, M-O-T-T, who had been, when he was picked to come to Washington for the NPS, had been the director of the California State Park System. And James Ridenour, R-I-D-E-N-O-U-R, who was from the University of Indiana, and he had something to do with Indiana, and I, again, frankly, don't remember his background. So, you know, we gave this dog and pony show, this briefing to the Secretary, and it turns out pretty much all of the agency heads, probably of the 10 agencies, there were probably eight or so agency directors or heads, whatever they were called, plus probably a bunch of their deputies and and others. And we gave this dog and pony show, and anything that had to do, that even looked like it had to do with incident command program, you know, we stuck up on the walls of the Secretary's briefing room, maps and photos and, lists and things that probably Jim nor I even really knew what we were talking about, but they looked good.
Uh-huh.
So I stuck them on the wall, and so we gave that briefing.
Hey, Butch, how do you spell Jim's last name?
R-I-D-E-N-O-U-R, or Loach, L-O-A-C-H.
Thank you.
James Ridenour, R-I-D-E-N-O-U-R. So I think I sort of said what I needed to do about it last time, didn't I, Tom, I believe?
Well, you and I were talking about it. I think we talked about it off the tape.
Oh, we did?
And,
oh, okay.
And it was...
Okay. Well, then I can, okay.
Yeah.
So, associate director, Jack Moorhead, asked us to do this. Jim and I responded the next morning. We're giving this briefing to the Secretary as well as a bunch of other upper management people. And we had a whole room full of these people. And it's the only time I've ever heard of, frankly, although I'm sure it's happened other times, but it's the only time that I was ever involved with that kind of firepower. In one spot at one time. And for me, and I think for Jim and maybe the Park Service, it was sort of unprecedented, actually, because, normally we would not be dealing with most of the other agencies, and certainly not collectively anyway.
Right.
So, you know, we spent several hours. It started out to be an hour or so, just a briefing, but as it turns out, it turned into several hours, and it was all brand new information for most of them. None of them had ever heard of ICS, Incident Command System. So we tried to give them a decent, which I think we did, a decent explanation of the process and how it will apply not only to the Park Service parts of the country, but others that, you know, these other agencies had responsibility for as well. And I think it came off very well. I mean, as far as I know, we did a good job. I think probably Jack thanked us and said that everybody appreciated it, et cetera. So
Nice.
I think that part was good.
So it was a great way to introduce the incident command structure and system to multiple agencies all at once.
Well, yes. I mean, we would be naive to think that it got any further than just those people, but you know, it served the purpose for the day, which was that's what we were supposed to do.
Nice.
It was our job for the day was to do this. You know, and we're in full uniform, which you know, something I might mention, I don't think I've mentioned this before, is that when I worked in Maine Interior, which was the headquarters for the National Park Service, most of the third floor of Maine Interior, that's how it's referred to, is Maine Interior.
Okay.
Because there are, you know, there are satellite buildings around the city that are, you know, ancillary parts of the Interior Department. But we worked in the main office, and which is, you know, my office in the Park Service, most of the Park Service offices were on the third floor, and the secretary was on the top floor, which I think was the fifth floor. And but one thing that we did, which I think everybody that worked with me there in the Park Service part of the operation wore our uniforms every day,
mm-hmm.
and 5 days a week. And it would be the exception when we didn't wear the uniform. And you pretty much professionally, you know, if you weren't in uniform, you showed up in a coat and tie. So I had a coat and tie, you know, hanging in my office just as a backup for whatever reason.
Okay.
But, you know, pretty much no other agency there. And I'm, well, first of all, let me say that not every person in the Park Service was wearing a uniform. One, many of them weren't supposed to. But two, even if they, in theory, were supposed to, they didn't. But in Ranger Activities, with Walt Dabney and Jim Loach and myself and Bill Hallinan, H-A-L-A-I-N-E-N, Hallinan.
Thank you.
And others, you know, we wore our uniform on a daily basis, and we took great pride in that. And people knew who we were, and I think we looked good, and we knew that we represented the agency. And as I say, almost no other person in that whole building, except for perhaps the people checking you through the metal detector at the bottom, sort of.
Right.
We're in uniform. And the only drawback, and I've always joked about this, but the only drawback is if I was going walking around town for some reason, perhaps to go out of the building to get lunch or, you know, on some sort of a mission to buy something or whatever, and I was in uniform, I was always afraid that one of these people, and there were a lot of homeless people living on the grates, you know, the hot air grates coming out of the sidewalk. I was always afraid that I would walk by and all of a sudden there'd be somebody going down and everybody would be looking to me to give him mouth to mouth and CPR. which I suspect I would have done, but, you know, it wasn't. I've given CPR 10 different times in my career, but it's not something I particularly wanted to do, you know, on a street in downtown Washington, D.C. with somebody that's homeless that, you know, with the HIV situation in those days being a big deal, kinds of stuff. But I did think I wanted to mention the, you know, the fact that we did wear our uniforms.
Yeah.
Which I think was pretty neat, personally. And then I was going to mention about Manny Lujan.
Uh-huh.
When we were working on this health and fitness program, down in the basement of the main interior was a sort of like a half-court basketball court. There was a not a super well equipped, but there was a little equipped gym with weights and a few things that would be helpful. I suspect today that there's probably a much bigger and better equipped facility than there was during my day because there weren't that many people interested, but there were. They would have, on a daily basis, they'd have not yoga, but, you know, where everybody gets together and does exercises together.
Yeah, like a organized fitness class type thing.
Well, and there's actually a word for it. I mean, and there are lots and lots of places around every city that has these.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I just forgot the name of it. But they'd have these classes, and generally there'd only be like, you know, it'd be two men, myself and this other guy that was actually in the park service, and, you know, there'd be 25 women, which I thought was kind of neat since I was single in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But also, on occasion, I would be down there, and I'd be playing basketball with the Secretary of the Interior.
Oh, fun.
And it wasn't like I was any great shakes at a basketball player because I was probably pretty pathetic, but he wasn't any better. And so there'd be he and I and one of his protection detail, which was U.S. Park Police, down there. And usually the park policeman would be sitting on the side because he was way out of shape, and I was actually in pretty good shape. So there'd be Manny and I, and... although I don't think I ever called him Manny.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be the secretary.
Right.
But, you know, and there are many places, you know, where you can, you know, there'd be times not only there, but when I'd be up on the fifth floor or something, you know, and I'd be standing, you know, in the urinal next to me would be the Secretary of the Interior.
So. Mm-hmm.
So I guess that was all I really wanted to say at this moment.
Were you ever able to leverage that proximity in a way, sort of an elevator speech about a problem that the Park Service had that you thought the Secretary should be aware of and could possibly take beneficial action for? You know, I hear these stories on occasion. You know, I was in the elevator and in stepped the Secretary, and
yeah.
Secretary said, "Oh, you're with such and such, aren't you?" And the guy said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, do you need anything from me?" And the guy in the elevator said, "Well, yeah, we're about ready to lose our such and such and so and so protection of this and that." And the Secretary said, "Oh, I'll look into it."
Yeah.
And did.
Well, you know, I think I probably did. But frankly, I can't remember any specifics.
Okay.
You know, my relationship to Secretary Lujan was casual enough in many ways that I could actually do that without feeling like I was overstepping any boundaries or anything. And,
right.
You know, he knew me in uniform as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew who I was, or not so much who I was, but what I represented anyway.
Right.
And, yeah, and I think, yes, I think the answer to your question is yes, although I do not remember any specifics. Now, you know, one thing I probably forgot to mention while in talking about Washington, D.C., there's probably a lot of things, right? But one thing I do remember is that I actually was on a detail the Deputy Secretary of the Interior, whose name I will have to dredge back up a little bit, but I worked for, I didn't work, he was not my, I stayed with the Park Service. I was on a detail.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I actually was doing two jobs at one time.
Oh, wow.
I was still holding down all of the stuff I was doing with the Park Service, you know, the health and fitness and EMS and diving and all the other stuff. But I was also working full-time pretty much for the deputy secretary on about a six-month detail where I started out, I was the first, this is actually kind of important, I guess, I was the Department of the Interior's first drug czar.
Huh.
Which meant that my principal purpose for a while anyway was to sort of get the foot in the door in terms of the war on drugs, which was a new thing that was taking place. And I guess I could probably go back into Google and figure out exactly what dates we're talking about.
Hmm.
Because that was a, you know, presidential announcement. We're going to do a, you know, war on drugs, right?
Right.
So I was the Department of the Interior's initial sort of drug czar. Now, that did not mean that I had any kind of influence. I did get a top secret clearance that, you know, in theory, I could participate in various meetings and things, which I don't think I did very much of. It mostly meant that I was trying to establish contacts and phone numbers and relationships and identify what needed to be done in the future and what does this war on drugs mean to us kinds of stuff, et cetera. But I don't remember all the real detail, but much of the Mexican-United States border is Department of the Interior, either between
right.
land management, Fish and Wildlife, Park Service. It's something like, I don't know, 50% of that border is actually Department of the Interior. It's a significant amount, whatever that amount is. It's a lot.
Right, there's Oregon Pipe and Big Bend. I'm just thinking about some of the national parks. But
the Bureau of Indian Affairs has got
that's right.
Tohono O'odham or Papago Reservation.
Right.
Big Bend.
It's certainly just simple BLM land.
Yeah, and then BLM land. And, you know, so there's a lot of it down there.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Texas, a lot of it's private. But New Mexico and Arizona in particular, there's a lot of federal land right on the border.
Yeah,
so
California
as well. Department of the Interior was kind of a big player in those days. But, you know, the entire effort was very, very infantile, not infantile, but in its infancy.
Yeah.
On getting it, you know, getting off the ground.
Okay.
So I did that. And then, I mean, that was part of my detail. And, oh, then I, you know, I was sort of a gopher for the deputy director, deputy secretary, who I can see his face, and he's a, you know, a nice person. He's a political appointee, obviously, but you know, very, very nice person.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for somebody that actually worked for him. I mean, he wasn't my immediate supervisor.
Okay.
But. You know, I did other kinds of missions working for this, you know, for this secretary or deputy secretary. And I ended up getting a commendation out of it. It was a special achievement award, I think, or something.
Nice.
So, so I did that. And I guess I must have transferred, or somebody else came in and was actually, what they were doing was recruiting for a quote unquote, you know, drug czar, somebody that would be taking over this war on drugs from the Department of Interior's perspective. And they knew that I wasn't doing that. It was just that they needed somebody that could hold the fort down for several months until they could find somebody that would do it on a full-time, you know, as they envisioned, for years to come.
Would that be a congressionally approved position?
No, not even close.
Okay.
No, now it might be eventually. I mean, I guess I don't really know that, but, you know, at my level, it was nothing more than just, you know, I was a GS-13.
A detail on assignment, and that's that.
Detail on assignment, and it was really just to, you know, get our foot in the door in terms of this big agenda that the president had. You know, and I mean, it wasn't that I didn't get involved with other agencies and other parts of the government, for that matter.
Right.
It's just that, you know, at this point, it was so low level in terms of getting off the ground that, you know, they didn't need somebody that was, you know, a GS-17 or something.
Right, right.
So,
okay.
I think that's all I can remember at this moment.
All right. Well, that's pretty good. And
And I did tell you about going. I did mention about going to Palau, or not going to Palau.
Yes.
And I guess officially, I told you on the tape, right?
Right. And then John Cook came in and wanted to know if you wanted to go to Padre Island. What can you tell me about John Cook? That's COOK.
Yeah, COOK. Well, he was third generation Park Service.
Okay.
His father and grandfather had been in the Park Service. His father was a superintendent along the way. His grandfather, I'm trying to think, I'm not so sure he had been a superintendent. And then his daughter, John's daughter, Casey, K-A-Y-C-I, Casey Cook, is a fourth generation. They sort of have this little dynasty going, right? And John was old school, traditional, very charismatic in many ways, but pretty hardcore, and he was somebody you did not want to cross. He had, you know, pretty good definition on what he wanted to see done and how he wanted to see it done in many ways. So I still stay in touch with John, although, I mean, we're not bosom buddies or anything, but he was my immediate supervisor. Well, I guess that's not totally true. He was my regional director when I went to Padre Island as the superintendent. I actually answered to Dick Marks. He was the deputy director, or regional director.
Okay, now, so this is kind of complicated. I want to make sure I understand it, because when you were at Grand Canyon, Dick Marks was the superintendent of Grand Canyon National Park.
Correct.
So you're in D.C. in 1989. Marks leaves Grand Canyon in 89 as well, I believe.
Is that right? Okay.
And he goes to become the regional director, is that right?
No, he goes to become the number two person in the Southwest region.
Okay, Southwest region. All right.
Yeah. And the Southwest region no longer exists. It's been absorbed into a larger, it's called the... what's called the Rocky Mountain region. I'm not so sure that its name hasn't changed again. But at the time, it was the Southwest region, and Dick was the number two person, and John was the regional director. And I often interacted with John. It's just that technically Dick was my immediate supervisor. But John came in a couple different times and asked, you know, sort of floated you know, the question of would I be interested in going to Padre Island National Seashore, which is Corpus Christi, Texas, if I would be interested in going. And in my mind, you know, the word interest has nothing more than the word interest. It doesn't mean obligation or commitment. It just means, yeah, I would think about it.
Uh-huh.
Well, John's definition was a little bit different than mine. He sort of thought that since I expressed an interest, that I was, you know, tacitly saying, yeah, I'd go. And I think I mentioned last time he actually had gotten it approved, which had to be done at the secretary's level, to go there without my even knowing about it. So, and John was one of these guys, I could have turned the job down once it was officially offered to me.
Hmm.
But John is not somebody that you really want to cross. And politically and professionally, not so much politically, but professionally politically, you know, once you did that, then, you know, at least working for him,
right,
would not be
right. Would not be, yeah. Yeah. So I'm a little confused, because if Dick Marks is the number two person for the Southwest region, and John Cook is the regional director, I'm confused between the Southwest region. I'm assuming that has a regional director. So,
well, John Cook's the regional director.
So Marks was working for Cook.
Yes. Right.
Okay. So guy. The two of them were in the same office, whether it was in Denver or Santa Fe.
Santa Fe.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
It hadn't gone to Denver yet at that point.
Okay.
And John would end up becoming, when they absorbed the Southwest with the Rocky Mountain region, or the old Rocky Mountain region, and they created a larger region, John became the director of it.
Okay.
Regional director of it. So,
interesting.
So I'm going to.
So did you know where Padre Island was? Did you know anything about it?
Not much.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I knew where Padre Island was, but just sort of barely. I'd never been there.
Okay.
What I really knew about Padre Island was that there weren't any mountains there. But, you know, I was at a point where, you know, I'm time to move on, and yep. my oldest son was pretty much ending his sophomore year in high school, and if I was going to move and make a, you know, move on, this was not a promotion at this point.
Okay.
On that, this was the time to do it, because I did not want to put him, because otherwise I would be there for another couple of years. And while I was in D.C., actually right at the end of this, all of this, I was being considered for a promotion there in the Department of the Interior.
Ah, okay.
Which was outside the Park Service. I would have been leaving the Park Service and going to the department as a GS-14, working for an associate secretary, whose name I have fortunately forgotten because he was a snake oil salesman. And I was told by somebody who would know, who was, you know, my senior by senior in terms of, you know, levels,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
of grade and what have you, that I had the job if I wanted it. But I also knew that it would commit me to at least a couple more years in Washington, D.C.
And you would be working for an associate secretary, which is a political appointee.
Yeah.
And so that person would be going through a revolving door and would leave you, you know, in a position ready to serve the next assistant secretary.
Yeah.
And you'd be working for Interior. Okay.
So So, I mean, I wouldn't have been in the Park Service. Now, the fact is I probably could have come back in the Park Service.
I see.
You know, I don't know that that would have been real hard because, you know, I was doing a good job there in Washington. And, you know, they would have, I say they, you know, the collectively management would have seen to it that I got out okay.
Okay.
But it also committed me to staying in D.C. Or in that job for a couple more years.
Right.
And, you know, there was just something, but so I guess here was the thing. My oldest son would have graduated from high school there, and that would have been okay.
In D.C.?
In D.C., yeah. you know, Virginia.
Right.
And, but my youngest son would have been partway through high school.
Right.
At that time. And that was one of the bigger decisions on my part. For deciding not to stay, you know, not to continue. I was not formally offered that job. I know that within the hour, practically, I would have been. And I was able to, I made the decision, which was hard, to decide to leave. And it had a lot of to do with my youngest son and his high school.
Okay.
Or his years in high school. I didn't want to screw him over because of the timing, you know, for high school for him. So I go to Padre Island, and I send my this is like in March, if I'm not mistaken. Let me think about this. So it's, you know, the school year has not ended for my sons in Virginia yet.
Okay.
It's probably roughly March, which is when I'm supposed to enter on duty in Corpus Christi. So my sons go to the state of Washington and live with their mother, which was fine with everybody. It was fine with her, fine with me, fine with them. And because then, you know, at the end of that particular year in school, they would be then spending the summer with her in Washington anyway. So that was good, and it gave me time to get oriented there in Corpus Christi and get my feet on the ground and find some place to live, a house to buy, because there was no park housing for me at that point. So they move up there, and I trundle off to Corpus Christi. I had two vehicles at the time, and I drove my Volkswagen van down there, which at this point, you know, already had like 16 years on it and 200,000 miles or something. So I remember driving the very first day without even finding a place to live or anything, although I think perhaps I'd actually located something by phone initially. But I remember driving through the entrance station at Padre Island, which is right on the Gulf of Mexico, and going through the entrance station, and the seasonal ranger, who was, you know, an older guy, even older than me at that point, his name was Fred, and I drove in there in my Volkswagen van, and he, you know, very polite, very professional. And I asked him a couple of questions, you know, just how are things going here? And I didn't introduce myself. He had no idea who I was initially. Right. But pretty quickly, he recognized that I was the new superintendent. And I kind of impressed him, and we got to be pretty good associates anyway after that. I impressed him by the fact that I was so low key and, you know, no kinds of fanfare or anything like that.
Right.
And Padre Island at the time, I think I had about roughly 60 employees, which included seasonal employees as well.
Okay.
Probably permanents there might have been 30. 35 perhaps permanent employees. And you know, I went in and the headquarters for the National Seashore is actually not in the park. It's actually about 8 or 10 miles away in suburb, if you will, a little community next to Corpus Christi called Flower Bluff. That's F-L-O-U-R, Flower Bluff. And that was where the, you know, that's where my secretary, my administrative officer, the chief of maintenance, the chief of resources, well, that's not true. The chief ranger, rather, and probably another 5 or 6 people worked out of. And then there was the office out in the park itself, which housed, you know, much of the rest of the staff, including the chief of maintenance. If I misled this recording, the chief of maintenance's office actually was in the park, as was the chief of resources. But the chief of interp, the chief ranger, my administrative officer, and a few others were actually in Flower Bluff.
Okay.
Is that clear enough? Did I screw that up?
Yeah. No. My question is, gee, that seems kind of odd to have two offices 8 miles apart with people that need to talk to each other. You know, you got maintenance. Maintenance needs to talk to law enforcement. Law enforcement needs to talk to, resource management. But they're doing that by phone because
they
hop in the car and drive over there. They're not going to be visiting with each other on a face to face. That seems kind of odd. I'm sure there's a reason for it.
There wasn't any building space out in the park.
Right.
We did some correcting on that. We actually were able to add on and do some subdividing of a few rooms and things. We actually expanded the facilities out in the park a little bit better.
Hmm.
And we did that. I mean,
so
the observation is great.
Were you aware of the problems that Padre had? Maybe it had no problems when you showed up, which would be great. But I imagine that, like every park, there are personnel problems, there are resource problems, there are law enforcement problems, trespass with neighbors. It just goes on and on and on, which could be issues. How did you get up to speed on those things?
Well, I had some marching orders from John Cook.
Oh. this is like Dick Marks. All right, I got some marching orders for you. This is what I want you to do. Take care of. Go do it.
That's right. That's
oh,
exactly
wow.
Right.
Okay.
And he had 3 or 4 things he wanted me to take care of while I was in the park. And one of them, my immediate predecessor, whose name I won't mention, but had been removed from that park because he had been drinking too much.
Okay.
And he wasn't put totally out to pasture, but he was put in the regional office where somebody could look, you know, could watch over him directly.
Okay.
So the sort of the health of the park staff was pretty much in the toilet.
Ooh.
The morale was bad. There were just some things that had taken place, either directly or indirectly, by my predecessor.
Okay.
That needed to be sort of smoothed over and at least, told that, you know, things are going to be better and we're going to work on this issue and that issue.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the marching orders, which I was pretty successful in doing. Another marching order had to do with my chief of resource management, a guy by the name of John Miller, who I had worked with a number of years before to Grand Canyon on the aircraft overflight issue, who was a resource specialist, if you will, at Grand Canyon. And I'm not exactly sure how this came about, but he ultimately ended up getting a law enforcement commission.
Hmm.
And He went from the Grand Canyon, and I don't think there was anything in between. He ended up at Canyon de Chelly.
Okay.
You know, which is on the Navajo Reservation.
Outside of Kayenta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he, well, not yet. Yeah, it's outside of Chinle, actually.
Chinle, yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you.
And he, immediately before I got there, within the year, and I say immediately, within the year before I got to Padre Island, he had been, he ended up killing a Navajo hood. A guy who was an older, you know, probably, you know, in his 30s or so, who had been out on the rim, and I think it was on the south rim of Deschaux, and had confronted some tourists at a an overlook, and had, I'm trying to remember if he actually, he got into a real, real confrontation with these people, and a seasonal ranger at Canyon de Chelly, who really had very little experience, went out to deal with this issue, and John Miller, who was off duty, was at home, but he lived in the park, had his radio on, which, you know, a lot of us did in those days,
mm-hmm.
had his home little handset radio on, heard this confrontation. He knew either this bad guy or knew of this bad guy, and he also knew the limitations on his employee, his seasonal ranger,
mm-hmm.
knew this was not going to end well. He goes out there and, gets involved, and very quickly, this guy, goes off the bad guy goes off the deep end
mm-hmm.
and rushes John and takes him over the edge of the cliff.
Oh my gosh.
You know, it's like a 600-foot cliff. Well, as luck would have it, 10 feet down, there's a ledge big enough that they both land on it. And John has shot this guy, but this guy is still alive. As this guy is rushing him, John has shot this guy. And, but the guy has enough momentum and he's still alive enough that he takes John over this cliff with him. And the guy's committing suicide in his mind, obviously, I think. But he's obviously very irritated, would be a subtle way to say this, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But they both go over the cliff, and John lives through this. The other guy dies, I think, just of the gunshot wounds. I don't think he falls any further either. And John's given a Department of the Interior Valor Award for this. He probably saves the life of this seasonal ranger. I don't know, the outcome of the tourists. I mean, they didn't get hurt or anything. I mean, I don't know what their involvement was with any of this afterwards, but John ends up getting this Valor Award, but he lives in Chinle, right next to Chinle. So John Cook and his chief ranger for the region, a guy by the name of Bill Tanner, they decide they need to remove John from the park for his own safety. And they move him to Padre Island.
Okay.
John Miller is much more interested in resources than he is, in law enforcement particularly. So he's made the chief of resources. But they also remove John Miller's law enforcement commission.
Okay.
And it isn't any kind of real punitive thing, but John Miller believes it is.
I would think that Miller's got, you know, it's just to kill anyone's got to be really, really hard, and to be killed, it's got to be really, really hard. And that, you know, this is a tight community; everybody knows everybody else. Yeah. And this sounds like it was in the days when there's no, the Park Service hadn't figured out, you know, the PTSD briefing, debriefing, type things, and a commission. You work hard to get that commission, to have that taken away from you,
yeah,
without understanding why. That'd be devastating on top of something else that's already devastating. Yeah. And to kill somebody, this is really, even, you know.
John Miller had been in Vietnam as a sniper.
Okay.
And, you know, in talking to me on quite a few occasions, because we were pretty much the same age,
okay,
and, you know, had some similar backgrounds and stuff, you know, John would confide in me about, you know, killing Vietnamese in Vietnam.
Okay.
I mean, that was his job.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Yeah, but his job at Canyon de Chelly is not to kill anybody.
No, that's right.
And so I would think he would take that quite differently. But
yeah, no, I'm not necessarily equating the two. I'm just
yeah,
saying that John's
yeah.
background was...
Yeah, no, very helpful to know. Yeah.
So John Miller ends up suing John Crook.
Okay.
And Bill Tanner, I think, at the same time. Because of what you just described, the fact that this commission was removed, and John felt that it, you know, reflected, you know, on him as it related to his peers, and that, you know, he wasn't necessarily wanting to be a law enforcement ranger at Padre Island, but he didn't think he deserved to have his commission taken away like that.
Right.
And John Crook, and I think Bill Tanner, felt that, I don't know what they felt, but I do know that I suspect that they thought it was needed to be done for some reason, and I guess I don't know that reason.
And I'm sorry, who was Bill Tanner?
So Bill Tanner was what would be the chief ranger
okay.
for the region, which meant that, you know, he worked in Santa Fe, and he sort of had, you know, overview responsibility for law enforcement in all the parks within that region.
Okay.
Which would be Texas, New Mexico, Arizona. I don't think it had anything to do with Utah. Oklahoma, for sure, I think.
Okay.
So that was the region, and that's what Bill Tanner did, was right. oversee that operation, right?
So what did Crook want you to do in the way of Miller? Because it sounds like John Miller took the issue into his own hands. He took recourse, which was litigation, to try to keep his commission or get it back.
Well, he wanted the lawsuit to go away.
Okay.
And and I eventually did that. But I worked at it a lot.
Mm, okay.
And what I ended up doing on this particular aspect of why I was going, you know, what I was supposed to do when I got to Padre Island. One of the things I did over time, this wasn't like I snapped my fingers, this
mm-hmm.
was over a couple of years, really,
right.
is one, I befriended John,
okay.
and I liked John.
Uh-huh.
John and I got along. John had a huge ego, but, you know, we did fine.
And you had known him, as you mentioned, from Grand Canyon, so...
Well, I mean, we weren't real friends there, just because we didn't go in the same circles. Right,
right. But you knew each other, and...
Yeah. We
yeah.
worked together.
Okay.
So, but one thing I did is I ended up having John Crook agree. I said, if I get, you know, some, there's probably a real technical legal term for this, but if I have, you know, some psychological analysis of John and his... fitness for coming back into you know, getting a law enforcement commission back, will you think about reinstating his commission?
Mm-hmm.
So John Cook, you know, thought about this. You know, okay, and I said, but in return, I'm talking to John Cook now, not John Miller.
Right.
But in turn, I would have to get John Miller to drop his lawsuit. So Cook agreed to that. So over time, I had John Miller go to a couple of law enforcement psychologists, for lack of a better term,
uh-huh.
who could assess his fitness for that job,
okay.
that fitness for having his commission reinstated. And he passed. I mean, he did okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I got these letters from these people, you know, these different entities saying that, he's fine, right? So, it took a long time to do this. And so John had to go back to not so much remedial law enforcement training, but some refresher training, and I got him into that.
Right.
And ultimately, I actually got John into a doctoral program with, Texas A&M, so that he had a master's degree in resources, of some aspect of resource management.
Nice.
And I got him into a doctoral program along with another lady who, they ended up getting married, although they weren't married at the time. And she's still there, actually, in Padre Island. She's the turtle woman for the Park Service.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Okay. And very well-respected and very, has done very well for herself. And mm-hmm. she ends up completing the doctorate, but he does not.
Okay.
But that's, sort of way at the end of my time there, which was 5 years.
Okay. But it sounds like, Miller wanted to keep his commission. He was able to do that. Cook wanted the lawsuit to go away. That happened.
Yeah.
Gosh, it seems like best outcome that could have happened out of that.
Well, pretty much. And as I say, it wasn't something, snap my fingers and it happened. It was a long slog.
Okay.
Lots of talking to John after hours and, I would go over to his home and vice versa on occasion for supper and, trying to smooth the way to get into his confidence and mm-hmm. to find out what the real issues were from his perspective. And John, had a healthy respect for himself. He did not like the way this all took place. He didn't like the way his... friends, Park Service friends and others probably around the country would view this commission being taken away. That was a real down thing for him.
In a way, I'm talking way out of place here, but it sounded like a clash of personalities between Cook and Miller.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think, all through these sessions, you've been very insightful on a lot of things, much more than I would have ever been. You're 100% correct. There was a lot of that, yes.
And you're the perfect guy to step in there and kind of smooth things out. Yeah, it would take some time, but I'm glad to know it happened. Hmm.
Well, I thought that personally, I thought they did John wrong, John Miller wrong.
Right.
And... he had, really gone way beyond the call of duty, taking care of his seasonal ranger at Canyon de Chelly. And I don't think that John Cook or Bill Tanner had any issue with that. I think they respected him for that. And that's probably the reason he ended up getting the Department of the Interior Valor Award, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't any denigration on that. It's just that... There were some hard feelings, there were some hurt egos,
et
cetera, and I don't know that I was the perfect person to come in and take care of that, but I ended up taking care of it. So that was one of the issues that That's right. There was
that Cook wanted you to take care of.
Yeah.
That you were not aware of when you said, "Oh yeah, I'm interested in that job."
Oh yeah, no, I didn't know. I didn't know any of that. No, I didn't know. And there were like three or four total reasons, two of which I've mentioned, and two of them I can't frankly remember. I'm trying to think. Maybe as I talk, they'll come back to me.
So what's it like as a Park Service employee to come in as a superintendent? You know, you kind of come in trying to come in under the radar screen, but you really can't. You're there in your VW Bug. You could be any visitor. And right away, the guy wearing the flat hat at the entrance booth has sized you up as the new superintendent. I would imagine that the other 30 employees there were all doing the same, and were worried about, you know, the normal things that federal employees worry about, which is, you know, you don't want to lose your job and you want to do a good job. And here comes someone new. And the last guy left us in a mess. It's got to be, you know, what did you do to try to rebuild the morale of that park?
Well, first of all, we need to understand here, Tom, that I did not have a Volkswagen Bug.
Sorry, a bus. A van. All right.
You know,
there's a difference. Yeah.
My snobbishness is probably showing through here.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I must have said something along the way as I was talking to Fred going through the entrance station that either led him to believe that I was the new superintendent. I don't think I actually admitted it to him. I didn't say, hey, here I am. Somehow I said something.
He probably saw the decal on the van saying, wait a minute, there's a parking sticker on this van from Washington, D.C. I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's not a bad observation. And I probably did have one from the Grand Canyon before that. Well, so, you know, I ended up having, and the government paid for this, and they, as they do for everybody that gets transferred in certain positions anyway, for, I don't know, 6 weeks or so, they paid my rental for a lodging. So I stayed in I rented an apartment in Flower Bluff, in an apartment complex. It was just a one-bedroom thing. So my staff, which was, half Hispanic, local hires principally, from around the area. One thing that I did that I think everybody should do is, one, you listen. So what are the complaints? What's the problem? What's going on here? Why are you here? What's your long-term plans, all of that sort of thing. And I did a lot of that on a one-on-one basis.
Okay.
I'd go out and ride with, various members of the staff, and not just at the upper level, not my key staff, but others. I'd go out and ride with them and work alongside them. I actually did a lot of things sort of hands-on. I have a great photo of me up to my chin in water pulling bulrushes out of this one spot, this one freshwater pond.
Huh.
And there weren't many freshwater ponds in Padre Island. It was mostly salt water. So I was happy and willing to get out there and, mix it up, just like I sort of hope that my entire career has been, which is, I was a hands-on supervisor and a hands-on manager as well as hands-on ranger.
I mean, that's pretty disarming right there, I think, for an employee, if the superintendent's willing to roll up their sleeves and wade in, just because I would think any employee would respond to that with senior management stepping in and wanting to listen. That's important.
Yeah. Well, and it was, and I'm basically pretty good at that, and so I did a lot of that. Not everybody was terribly, not everybody was had super bad morale.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't like the entire park was moping around every day.
All right, thank you.
But they were, you know, over time had been sort of shell-shocked by the previous superintendent, for one thing. So, you know, all of a sudden, here's a guy that's willing to listen and try to fix things and get things done. You know, I always enjoyed getting things done. I was sort of a list person. I'd make a list. And, okay, you know, I like checking the list off,
mm-hmm.
checking something off. So we did a lot of that. One of the things I found early on that I wasn't quite prepared for was one day I went out with the chief of maintenance, who was my senior by age by probably 10 years. Bob LaFrance was his name. That's capital L, small a, capital F as in Frank, R-A-N-C-E, LaFrance, just like the fire engine. And he'd been around in a number of parks, and he had a lot of fire background. So we actually enjoyed each other's company and talked about common friends, you know, throughout the system.
Uh-huh.
He'd worked in Sequoia and Kings Canyon, for one thing.
Okay.
You know, where I had some acquaintances from years before that he worked with as well. So, but one time early on, he and I are out there, and Padre Island had this huge parking lot. I mean, it was, you know, big enough for, you know, what the, you know, some big football dome stadium parking had practically.
Why did it have such a big lot?
Well, because they were going to have this big maintenance area, and they had some other long-term plans for infrastructure being put in, which didn't get put in. They got the parking lot, but they didn't get the rest of it in there. And, you know, I ended up getting a lot of it removed eventually.
Okay.
But you know, you don't do that the first day. So within the first couple of weeks, I'm out driving around with Bob, and one of the things I always like to do, you know, in places that I had any kind of control, was I just say, well, how come we have this here? Why is this pipe sticking
mm-hmm.
out of the ground? And in this case, I made the comment about why is this light pole in this particular spot or something like that effect? And because the lights weren't on. I mean, that particular light wasn't on. It wasn't being used, et cetera.
Okay.
It was pretty much worthless. But I said, well, how come this pole's here, you know? And sure, shoot, within a couple of days, that pole was gone.
Hmm.
And I got back to Bob, and it wasn't that I was mad or anything. It was like, you know, Bob, just because I ask a question does not mean that I, you know, am disappointed or that I want something done. It's just I'm asking the question. It's sort of like, are you interested? Well, yeah, I'm interested, right? So I asked Bob, well, why is this pole around here, you know? He probably gave me an answer, but, you know, we're continuing to drive and going on to another something pretty minor, relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And, but the next thing I know, a couple of days later, that pole's no longer there.
So he's looking at the park in new eyes as well and seeing, oh, yeah, that there's no reason for that to be there. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
And I, you know, I, you know, again, sort of old school, if it's not necessary,
right.
Even if it's there, if it's not necessary and won't be necessary in the, you know, the future, so maybe we ought to get rid of it. Maybe it's a distraction to the public. Maybe it's a distraction to us. Maybe it's a hazard. I don't know, but maybe it doesn't need to be there. You know, another example of this, although it's not a totally analogous, I guess, but we had, there were only a couple of paved roads in all of the entire park. I bet you there wasn't more than, I don't know, 10 miles total that was paved.
Okay.
Now, the 66 miles of the seashore, which goes down, the, you know, follows all the way down the coast, is actually by state law a state highway, the beaches.
Really? How'd that happen?
so you could drive. Well, it's just when the park was set aside in order to get the property that the Department of the Interior, the federal government, agreed to the stipulation by the state of Texas that if you want our land here, and of course, you know, the state of Texas had to buy some of it as well. If you want this land, you know, here are a couple of stipulations. And one stipulation is that, you know, it remains a state highway.
The beach is a state highway. I have to think about this for a while. I have to think about turtles. I have to think about birds, nesting birds in a state highway. That's interesting.
Well, we didn't have too many nesting birds per se, but we did have peregrine falcons, which are endangered. We did have the Kent's Ridley turtle, which was endangered, which comes into play later on in this period of time here. Which actually, as I look on the clock on the wall, as George Goebel used to say, you know, actually we're getting close to end of year, right? Or at least the time period.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, so the example I was going to give is there's a big curve in this one of these paved roads, and it goes out to called Bird Island Basin. Three words, bird, as in flying bird, and island, as in something island, and, you know, basin. There's this curve. And there must have been, honest to goodness, there must have been 10 or more of these yellow and black, little signs that go into the ground that warn you about a curve.
Okay.
There's probably, good words for that, but I don't know what it is right now. And they start way before they're necessary.
Like a little line, half circle sort of line with an arrow on it, or quarter circle.
Not so much about the circle, but the black lines, like a little arrow, the tip of an arrow.
Yeah.
Showing which way the curve is going.
Oh, okay, got it. All right.
And on the background is yellow, and the arrow is black.
Okay.
And it's just, it warns you that there's a curve there, and that's pretty standard throughout the country.
Right.
But there's way too many of these things.
Huh.
And it's like, anytime we got signs, we need to look at signs, which we did. I mean, that was part of what I did, was look at all the signs in the park. Is that sign necessary?
Right.
We need to have that sign anymore. And if we don't need it, let's get rid of it. And I was real good about that. Well, anyway, Jesus, we went from, I don't know if this is hyperbole or not, but we go from, say, 12 or so of these black and yellow signs just leading up to this curve down to about 5 or 6.
Okay.
And the speed limit's only 35 to begin with.
So people aren't going super fast.
No, they're not going. They're not supposed to be anyway.
Right.
And so we remove half of those signs. Now, if you go out there today, I don't know what exists.
Right.
But I know that there's probably a lot of stuff that was up that probably is no longer there, and nobody misses it.
Right. Right.
So that was, just another example of... But your original question was, a lot of it had to do with listening. A lot of it had to do with being empathetic to what's going on in the park.
Right.
I know that this part of the budget is reduced or is not as much as it should be or could be. How can we fix that? And where can I go to get, some other kinds of funding for, a particular part of the operation, et cetera. So that's, somewhat how I was able to help take care of the problem.
Okay.
Or the morale.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that I was willing to do this and I, the fact that I showed up sober.
Yeah.
And that I was working, much more than 8 to 5. Because I didn't, once my kids were gone, which becomes another issue, but, for the first 5 months, I don't have any real reason to go home.
Right.
there's nothing there. I devoted a lot of time, and I was there after hours and trying to work on stuff. And so.
Nice. Okay.
Anyway.
All right. Well, this sounds like a good place to think about wrapping up this part, which gets us into Padre Island, and maybe next time we can talk about more of that.
Yeah, no, there's some big time issues. One thing, I get sued for $150 million at Padre Island.
And okay.
For 2 years, there's three lawyers from the Department of Justice that are defending me and the Secretary of the Interior and the regional director, I guess, from this lawsuit.
Okay. Well, that's a good topic for next time.
It's the biggest thing I did at Padre Island.
Okay. Well, hopefully that will open up some of the other smaller things that you did as well. That'd be great. All right. So with that, this will wrap up part 19, oral history interview with Butch Farabee. Today is July 13, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Butch, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.